Okay, well, I'm going to start with the set-aside prayer. God, please set aside everything I think I know about you, God, the steps, recovery, the big book, what's best for me, what's best for others. Especially help me let go of all my old ideas and live on your spiritual truth. Heavenly Father, have mercy on me, a sinner. Help me carry your message tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, we started to wives at the last meeting, and this chapter is really one of the lost chapters. People don't read it. They don't read to wives, to employers, family afterwards, fantastic. They just skip them, or they skip a vision for you. And I must admit, it's an honest program, right? For the first few years, I didn't cover these because Joe and Charlie didn't cover them, but they only had a one weekend. So somebody said, well, why don't you cover these? And I didn't know, so that I started covering them. And they've been great. These chapters have helped me so much. To wives is really to alcoholics, to everybody who has our disease and the people affected by it, and also people who have codependency issues. So it's really for everybody, but we got to page 105, but I'd like to review. In this first page, on the third paragraph, it says, we want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. I'll read that again. We want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. And, of course, with God. And they're not talking about getting a new car or if you have cancer, getting cured of cancer. They're talking about that feeling of bondage to self, that feeling of fear and constant discontent. And any situation, you can handle it with God. Isn't that a great hope? To me, it's just a great statement. And it says, we have traveled a rocky road. There's no mistake about that. We have had a long rendezvous with hurt pride. Anybody ever have hurt pride? Frustration. And hurt pride just produces resentment, right? It's like the same word, frustration, self-pity. Anybody ever have self-pity? Anybody ever feel misunderstood? Anybody feel like my motives were great? Why are they treating me like this? It's ridiculous. And of course, fear. And so we had an appointment with it. And you can say that's true for the wives, and it's true for us as alcoholics. And I think it describes alcoholism. And I wrote in my book, Appointment in Samara, Rendezvous. That's a famous fable. Do you know it, Jason? You know all that. You were English. The guy says he's deaf, and he comes to the town, and they say, somebody asks him where he's going. He says, I have an appointment in Samara. And then John O'Hara wrote a really good book about, with that as the theme. Anyway, I got off. I used to read a lot. And I wrote here, it's not what happened in my life that was a problem. It's how I reacted to it. Anybody relate to that? Now, I wrote that down. I don't know where I got it from. It says, we have been driven to maudlin sympathy, the wives, the alcoholic, bitter resentment. And then the next paragraph, I think I covered it. They talk about what they did to try to help the husband. We have been unselfish and self-sacrificing. We have told innumerable lies to protect our pride. So you see, even though they were trying to help the alcoholic. They had their pride. They didn't want to be married to such a loser. And they were trying to give him an excuses and our husband's reputation. We have prayed, we have begged, we have been patient. And they're praying and begging and patient to get what they wanted, which was the alcoholic to stop drinking. And so they were making the alcoholic their higher power. You see that? And we do the same thing when we have anger or resentment or fear. We make that our higher power, whatever we're afraid of, whoever we're angry at. It doesn't work well, does it? No. It says, we have sought sympathy, we have had retaliatory love affairs with other men. Our homes have been battlegrounds, many an evening. And you don't have to have alcoholics live together to have a battleground. You could have two non-alcoholics whose house is a battleground because they're both self-centered and they're living in self, and the other one's not doing what they want. But this is life-saving information and action for us. They are not dying of alcoholism. They're just spiritually dead. So that's the problem. We have a disease that will kill us physically and mentally. But the great thing about alcoholism, and Lyle said it, is it leads us to a spiritual life if we do this we never would have had. And so I don't regret that I'm an alcoholic. I wouldn't be here tonight. I wouldn't have this relationship with the Lord that I do today. I would have just still been a self-centered mess, making bad decisions. Anybody else getting upset, frustrated, impatient, tolerant? Anybody else that way? Yeah. It wasn't fun, and it was exhausting. Was anybody exhausted when they got here? Yeah, it's exhausting running your world. We seldom had friends at our homes, never knowing how or when the man of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. So if you're an alcoholic, how are you at home when people came? How are you in social engagements? We came to live almost alone. But they weren't alone. We're never alone. We're alone with our own old ideas, right? We're alone with our expectations. And so we're never alone. We're alone with our self-centered or old ideas. And there, we should be alone with God. And when I'm with God, I'm not alone, right? And so when we were invited out, our husband sneaked so many drinks that they spoiled the occasion. Anybody drink before they came home so the wife wouldn't know, or hide alcohol? Anybody here hide alcohol? Okay, all but one. Because you're a spiritual seeker. The only people who hide alcohol are alcoholics, because it's legal. I mean, why would I hide? My wife doesn't hide alcohol. That's how you can tell if you're an alcoholic. Did you ever hide liquor? Yeah. In fact, I know people who've sobered up and found booze. And if, on the other hand, they weren't drinking, their self-pity made them killjoys. So the way we look to people when we're in self-pity is not good. I've had alcoholics call me in self-pity, and I'm listening to it, and I have to move the phone away, you know, because it's just a song of poor me, and why this happened to me, and I guess it's a form of My Way by Frank Sinatra, but they don't sing it as well. Self-pity is a killer. I can get into self-pity. I have a treatment for self-pity, though. It works for me every time. I turn to page 100, and I read, when I look back, I realize that the things that came to me when I put myself in God's hands were better than anything I could have planned. And that's true. My life is so much better than I deserve today. How can I have self-pity? I'm lucky I'm alive, right? And I have everything I need because I have a relationship with God. So I always look, think, remember, when I look back, the things that have happened when I put myself in God's hands were better than anything I could imagine. So, Jimmy, we're at the bottom of page 105. There was never financial security. That was in a family. Remember, the wives didn't work in 1938 when they wrote the book, and the husbands were a mess, and how'd they have food? And our country was really a mess then. We had a lot of unemployment. We had a lot of poor people in the 30s. We didn't really come out of that till we had the war. And positions were always in jeopardy or gone. You've seen that old movies where the guys were waiting in line, they try to get a job that day, and they'd only pick a few. Positions were always in jeopardy or gone. I love this. An armored car could not have brought the pay envelopes home. The checking account melted like snow in June. So, alcoholics always had money to do what they wanted. Right? We came first, then everything else. And so in those days, it was really tough, and I'm sure that's true today in some families. Sometimes there are other women. How heartbreaking was this discovery? How cruel to be told, and who told them, that they understood our men as we did not? So somebody would rationalize their behavior. Isn't that amazing that that could happen? Anybody ever rationalize their decisions or their behavior? I'm still thinking about the Falcons drafting the quarterback when they paid the other guy $100 million. Yeah, they were rationalizing. I watched the press conference. I said, boy, that's like an alcoholic describing why they took the first drink. It seemed like a good idea, right? So, the bill collectors, I'm going to get texts from people from Atlanta. I'm just joking. Who hear the podcast? The bill collectors, the sheriffs, the angry taxi drivers, policemen, bums, pals, even the ladies they brought home. Our husbands thought we were so inhospitable. So you're bringing home all these people, and they're wondering why. Because it was a different world then, remember? They lived in these little in communities, the streets, the block. Joy killer, nag, wet blankets, that's what they said. Anybody ever come in and thought that their spouse was a nag or companion? Anybody not? Well, of course, because we drove them completely crazy. And they wanted things differently. We have tried to hold the love of our children for their father. We have, and remember, you can substitute wife. And we have told small tots that father was sick, which was much nearer the truth than we realized. Nowadays, there are a lot of divorces. There's a lot of separation. So a lot of people come to AA and those relationships are gone. They're still trying to repair the relationships with their kids. And they don't, it's hard sometimes in the beginning, they can't see how they harm their children living with them or being alcoholics. Anybody kick out a door panel, smash treasured crockery, rip the keys out of pianos? In the midst of such pandemonium, they may have rushed out, threatening to live with the other woman forever. They should have let him go.
Yeah.
But in desperation, we have even got tight ourselves, the drunk to end all drunks. The unexpected result was that our husbands seemed to like it. And so this is the kind of behavior that we did and caused chaos in our homes, with our relationship partners, with our children. So we harmed people. We made decisions based on self, which put ourselves in a position to harm and to harm other people. So this is really a good first step chapter, isn't it? What it was like, an unmanageable alcoholic life. Perhaps at this point we got a divorce and took the children home to father and mother. Then we were severely criticized by our husband's parents for desertion. Usually we did not leave. And that's the thing, it's amazed when I hear stories of how people stayed with them for so long. We stayed on and on. We finally sought employment ourselves as destitution faced us in our families. And I've seen people in recovery who have kept drinking and kept their alcoholic behavior, and their wives finally had to give up on them. And then they just said, well, you know, that's okay. And within a month or two, they got another one. And they were married to this woman for like 14 or 15 years. Stu and I know this one guy. Well, you know, he couldn't see how he harmed her, how he hurt this woman so terribly, his behavior. And finally, she just couldn't go on. And I've seen several examples like that. And then the alcoholic so self-centered, he said, well, I'm better off without her. And then they just move on, and they just, and then if they do sober up, they can look back at that. And it's so sad, they feel so bad. But when you're doing it, you can't see your self-centered decisions, can you? No. And so I get a lot out of this chapter. I know I'm just babbling, but I hope it's helpful. We began to ask medical advice as the sprees got closer together. The alarming physical and mental symptoms, the deepening pall of remorse, pall is covering of remorse, covers the house, depression, inferiority that settled down on our loved ones. So they had remorse, depression, inferiority. That's just untreated alcoholism, right? It's just self-pity. And then it settles down. These things terrify and distract us. It's hard to see somebody destroying their life, isn't it? And it's repeated over and over. It says, as animals on a treadmill. That's what we, anybody keep relapsing? Anybody do that? It's like we're in a treadmill. And then we have patiently a weary climb, falling back in exhaustion after each futile effort to reach solid ground. And that's what happens if we try to fix ourselves, right? If we try to solve this ourselves, we just keep failing. Does anybody know why? Anybody listening?
Doing the same thing.
We don't have the power. Willpower won't work. It's only God. And we keep trying. Anybody have plans? Did they make plans to how they were going to recover and get sober and all that? I had a week I took off the work, and I was going to get my shit together that week. And so, of course, on Saturday and Sunday, I didn't have to do it yet, because I had the whole week. And then on Monday I said, well, you know, I can wait till Wednesday, and I didn't make it. And it was really bad. I was really, really in bad shape when I came in here. Many of us have entered the final stage with its commitment to health resorts, sanitariums, hospitals, and jails. And it's treatment centers now. I had somebody write a comment about, I wrote on step zero, you know, what step zero is and my thoughts on recovery that nobody in the room has looked at on the site, but that's okay. So I looked up step zero, and of course, you know, the thoughts like the third one down, but there are step zero treatment centers, and there's step zero counseling. And step zero is when you decided your life is unmanageable and you need help and you're an alcoholic, but you don't do any work. You don't do the steps. You don't have a relationship with God, so nothing changes. And you can't stay at step zero very long if you're a real alcoholic without drinking. And that's why I got that from a speaker I heard on XA Speakers, the idea that it made a lot of sense to me. So that's why I try to get people into the action in the steps right away. I mean, that's what Dr. Bob did. The only mistake with that is some people haven't taken the first step. And if they haven't taken the first step, it's not going to work. But I can't tell if someone's taking it or not taking it. You know how you can tell? If they do the work. You give them assignments, they do it. If they don't do it, they're not defeated. Under these conditions, death was often real. Right? Under these conditions, we naturally made mistakes. And they made a lot of mistakes in trying to help us. And we've made mistakes too. And here's the biggest mistake I think people make, is they think they have some power to change the other person. I don't have power to change my wife. And I think I do. I'll give you an example tonight. We had pasta, and she wanted to know if she should save some. And she had spaghetti sauce. So she said, I said, well, yeah, she decided she would save some. So she's putting the pasta in, and I had to tell her how to do it. You get it? I did it automatically. I said, well, you can put all of it in. And I didn't have to say that. She could figure out what she wanted to put in there. So I'm getting better. I mean, that was a spiritual experience. I said, I don't really have to tell you that, do I? She says, no. But she says, I'm used to it. So, but you see how it is? We think we have the power to direct other people to change their behavior. We don't. Remember, it says, we read it tonight, Stu. Our problems are of our own making, and they arise out of me. And I was the one that made the problems. It's not them. And I can change myself, and I don't have to change them. So I'm trying to make this so it's applicable to the husband or the wife. Some of those rose out of ignorance of alcoholism. And I could say, are you ignorant of your alcoholism? Do you know why you're an alcoholic? See, we don't have power to change ourselves, and they don't have the power to change us. And that's why the medical profession has a great treatment for this. They send you to AA. Now, they have no idea what we do in AA, but they know they don't have any power. Now, what happened in America, the treatment centers started because they could get paid for, quote, treating alcoholism. And they have these treatment plans. Now we have intense outpatient therapy, and we have all this. People making a lot of money off of addiction and alcoholism. But I don't know that they're affecting the cure rate or the recovery rate. I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that. But I know this works, but you can't charge $15,000 for a big book. And then there are a lot of alcoholism counselors who've never read this book. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I know this book has been the treasure map for me to God. And that's why I believe in it so passionately. Sometimes they sense they're dealing with sick men or women. Had we fully understood the nature of the alcoholic's illness, we may have behaved differently. And it's true. But here's the problem. When your son dies in his car at 5 in the morning, how can you not wonder if you could have done something differently? If you could have made different decisions. And God helped me with that, and people in AA helped me with that. And I did the best I could. And the thing that helped me was he had no power to do anything different. And I had no power to change him. And so, but that's hard. But I don't feel guilty anymore. I didn't really feel guilty. God helped me, people in the program, the steps, inventoried it, and I did the best I could. And he had no power to do different. He wasn't good or bad, he was powerless. And so I thought God maybe, he didn't want him to suffer. He would have lived longer and suffered and maybe done horrible things to people, who knows. That's in God's hands, but I did the best I could. And so, but I understood that I was powerless. And how could men who love their wives and children be so unthinking, so callous, so cruel? Isn't it true? You know why? You know why alcoholics who love their women, their wives, and their children could be so unthinking, so callous, or cruel? Because they loved alcohol more than them. And the alcoholic can't understand that what we've done to these people in relationships because we've chosen alcohol over them. Well, we don't understand why they're still mad at us, you know. I'm sober 20 hours or something. And it sounds silly, but we chose alcohol and ourselves over these people we loved. Now, we didn't have any power to do differently, but it's that's why it's so hard to repair these relationships, and they can't be repaired in a quickly. It says there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. There could be no love in such persons, we thought. Well, that's true. They loved alcohol more than them. Now, I don't think they realized it at the time. But when you look at it, if you're working with someone, you say, well, she's upset. Well, you loved alcohol more than her. You know, and that has to affect her. Just as we were convinced of their heartlessness, they would surprise us with fresh resolves and new attentions. And for a while, they would be their sweet, old sweet selves, only to dash the new structure of affection to pieces once more. You see how we broke hearts? We were like a tornado, right? Coming out of the cellar after a tornado and say, oh my, there's nothing wrong, the wind stopped blowing, and we left all this wreckage. And and when you look at your four step and you look at it, it's pretty sad. But I realized the things I did were not because I was a bad person, I was selfish, but I had the wrong manager. I had me, and I should have had God. And if God was my manager, I wouldn't have made those decisions. And so I don't want to make those bad decisions anymore. And it says, could we have been so mistaken in the men we married? When drinking, they were strangers. Sometimes they were so inaccessible, it seemed as though a great wall had been built around them. Well, we built a wall too, didn't we? And what was the biggest wall I built? What's my favorite paragraph in the book, Stu?
I see an intellectual amount.
Bill W. Let's turn to it, because this
page
is
two.
Now it's like page 8. Page 12. He's meeting with Ebby. Bill W. is meeting with Ebby Thatcher. Ebby's come to see him. He's 30 days or 60 days sober. They told him he had to witness to someone, so he goes, sees Bill W. in November of 1934. They're in his kitchen, and Ebby's talking about God. And Bill didn't want to hear about God. He had all these reasons. Because Bill wanted to be the God of his life, and he wanted to be the center. And so he resisted the thought that there could be some czar of the heavens or whatever, because then he'd have to be accountable. Now, I hear a lot of people say they don't want to hear about God. So it says, my friend suggested that what seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? Right?
Yeah.
But it has to be, it says on page 83, it has to be, makes sense. No, it's in working with others. He says you could choose any concept that you like, but it has to make sense. It can't be a doorknob. Or somebody wanted to have the AA group, their higher power. Wow. Look around. Do you want these people to be your higher power? But they would say it. But you want it to be something you can go to at 3 in the morning when things are bad, and you can go to that higher power, and you can talk to that higher power and form a relationship with him. So he says, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in his intellectual mountain in his mind, in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. So he built this icy intellectual mountain in his mind between him and God, and he lived in the shadow and shivered. And it said, I stood in the sunlight at last. To me, that's just, that's when you see the truth of what's blocking you from God, and you can open your heart to God, and he's there. You stand in the sunlight. Now, that's really from the scriptures, from the New Testament. You want to live in the darkness, which is where we do, or do we want to live in the light? I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required to make my beginning. That's it. And I saw that growth could start at that point upon the foundation of complete willingness. Here it is. I have to be completely willing. I might build what I saw in my friend, a relationship with God. All right, so we'll end there. And where was I when I stopped?